So we're going to start now. Make sure I've got my podcasting thing on here. All right, the goal today... Oh, wait, the screen came back down. Why didn't the screen go up? Who's laughing? I hear somebody laughing. Screen up, wait. Well, I don't know why that projector light is on, but I'm going to leave well enough as is. Okay, what I want to do today is walk you through a little bit what I handed out to set up the session that you're going to have, the breakout session this afternoon. The subject matter is managing a publicly funded managed care initiative. As many of you know from our discussion of Medicaid and CHIP and Medicare earlier in the semester, the states and the federal government in the mid-90s began thinking they wanted to convert Medicaid beneficiaries from the old-fashioned fee-for-service Medicaid program to a new managed care initiative. The theory was, under fee-for-service Medicaid, you gave beneficiaries a card and you told them, go out and find yourself a healthcare provider, but you did so in an environment in which relatively few providers were willing to accept that card. It was hard for Medicaid beneficiaries to get good quality care, and the program was costing a lot of money. So by the mid-90s, the theory was, well, let's get people into managed care initiatives. We could save some money. We can provide better access to good quality care. We could provide better access to primary and preventative services. We could do all sorts of wonderful things. It soon became clear, however... I lost it? Did I do something wrong here? Is it still... This isn't my fault, I want you to know. I mean, I'm a little technologically challenged, but I'm not terrible. It soon became clear to Medicaid officials, however, that running a managed care initiative was a lot more difficult and a lot more administratively challenging than simply paying bills in a Medicaid fee-for-service environment. There were and there are all sorts of tasks, all sorts of decisions, all sorts of criteria that need to be established, implemented, and carried out. And so what I wanted to do today, and we're essentially 1 week behind now in the schedule, because if you look at the schedule, on March 27th, we're supposed to be talking about long-term care. We're going to get to that next week. I'll make up the... I'll get us back on track in the next few weeks. But I wanted to take a day, because we have the breakout sessions today, I wanted to take a day to really talk about managing a managed care initiative and what some of the tasks are, what some of the issues are, what some of the questions are. And so we're going to walk through, in effect, the memo that I handed out to you. And then we're going to break out into sessions, and then you guys are going to pick and choose and create your own managed care initiative. You're going to pick and choose on all these various questions that I asked, which beneficiaries you want to cover, what benefits you want to cover, how you want to, pay health plans, how you want to, supervise quality of care, all the kinds of things that are laid out in that memo. So that's the task. And then you're going to report back, as last time, to me and your TAs via email with your model managed care initiative. So the first question on that memo and the first question that comes up whenever a state is thinking about a managed care initiative, the first question is, which beneficiaries do we want to include in the initiative? And here's why this is so important. Medicaid is a program that is comprised of three very, very different populations. You've got young moms with kids. You've got elderly folks. And you have young disabled folks. Three very different kinds of political, three very different kinds of administrative, three very different kinds of economic groupings. And so the first question that comes up is, do you want to start your initiative by requiring all three of those groups, or by encouraging all three of those groups to enroll in managed care plans of one sort or another, or do you want to pick and choose, have one group in, one group out, and so on and so forth? Where do you think states started? When states started their initiatives, which of those three groups do they start with? Excuse me? I hear mumbling, but I don't hear any. I hear mumbling, mumbling, and kids. Anybody? Yeah.
Young healthy adults.
Young healthy adults and their kids. And their kids. And why do you think that state started with those, with that population? There's more of them. That's true. There are lots of them. Yeah.
Their care is
cheaper. Absolutely. Yeah. The elderly and the disabled, well, the elderly and disabled had Medicare. They all had Medicaid. I think maybe what you're saying is many of the elderly and disabled, because they have Medicare, already had what seemed to be a regular and decent provider network that they were in and so on and so forth, while Medicaid beneficiaries often had no doctor of their own. I mean, it's more likely that a disabled folk or a senior citizen, you know, these days would have their own doctor, their own care system. Is that kind of what you're getting at? Okay. Anybody else? Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. It's almost the opposite of ethics. Although it's one reason was politics. Because when you say the kids are the most important group, well, that's true. But on the other hand, when it came to enrolling groups into managed care plans in an era at a time when managed care was not a particularly popular model, and there was a big managed care backlash, the elderly and the disabled had far more and have more political influence. You know, the elderly vote. The disabled vote. Welfare moms and their kids don't vote as much and are much less politically influential. So if you're worried about political backlash and you want to push one group in as opposed to another, you're more likely to start out with welfare moms and kids. Is there a hand somewhere back here? I thought. Okay. I mean, it certainly was the case for most states that they started with moms and kids for a number of the reasons that you guys have suggested. If there was and if there is, yeah. Well, the family is typically the mom and the kid. You know, historically, Medicaid has been a program that's had categorical eligibility, and it's been relatively tough for two-parent families to enroll, to have eligibility for Medicaid. That's changed a little bit in the last several years with CHIP and some of the expansions in Medicaid. But the large majority of kids on Medicaid are in single-parent families. I suppose the poster child for state Medicaid managed care initiatives is and was the 12-year-old kid living at home with their mom on welfare who develops a sore throat. And because of that sore throat, the mom doesn't have a doctor. The mom takes that kid to the ER. And the mom and the kid sit in the ER for 8 hours. And after 8 hours, they finally see a doctor. And the doctor says, all right, you know, here's an antibiotic, go home. You know, the poster child was kids that were, you know, the idea was, let's get this population that doesn't have access to regular care, that doesn't have a primary care doc, that is getting their primary care. And this gets back to the point that was made earlier about the difference between the Medicare populations and the Medicaid populations. let's get the kid that's really not in a system of any sort, and let's get that kid into a system and that mom into a system. And so instead of bringing her kid to the ER for 8 hours and, you know, wasting a lot of their time and wasting a lot of the mom's time and using resources in the ER and costing a lot of money, let's find that kid a primary care doc by enrolling that kid in a managed care plan. So that's one reason they started with moms and kids. Another reason they started with moms and kids was politics, as we talked about earlier. A third reason they started with moms and kids is managed care plans had experience. Their bread and butter was taking care of families and young kids. That was most of the enrollees in managed care plans. You had relatively few elderly and disabled enrolled in managed care. Forget about Medicaid in the commercial market. So you had relatively few managed care plans that focused on and emphasized populations around the elderly and disabled. So for all of those reasons, when states started managed care initiatives in the early mid-90s, they started with welfare moms and their kids, and they did not start with the elderly and the disabled. Indeed, today, in 2006, and I think I've mentioned this previously, there's only one state in the country that requires all of their Medicaid beneficiaries, moms, kids, elderly, disabled, everybody. There's only one state in the country that requires everybody on Medicaid to be in managed care. And what state is that? Arizona. It's Arizona. Now, what's the problem? You know, the one person made a comment a few minutes ago that you know, moms and young kids are pretty cheap. Doesn't cost a lot of money. And that's true. But what's the problem? If you're a state official and you're looking, among other things, to save money by having a managed care initiative, the fact that moms and kids don't cost a lot of the money, the fact that, and again, these statistics are in one of your readings, and I may get them a little bit wrong, but something like 70-75% of the beneficiaries on Medicaid are moms and young kids, but they only account for 20-25% of the cost of the program. 20-25% of the beneficiaries are the elderly and the disabled, but they cost 75% of the dollars. So if one of your goals in converting beneficiaries to managed care is to save money, then focusing on moms and kids can be problematic. Because your most expensive populations, your chronically ill, your disabled, your elderly, are outside of that managed care system. So inch by inch, step by step, moment by moment, states are moving to add the elderly and the disabled to their managed care initiatives, but they're moving there very slowly. So first question that state officials have to think about and decide is, which population are they going to emphasize among those three populations? All three, just moms and kids, just the elderly and disabled, just the elderly, which population? So that's the general overview on that question. Second question that states have to think about when they're doing managed care initiatives is, what should the benefit package look like? What should the managed care benefit package look like? Oh, except I have that as the third question. Let's do your second question, the one you have here. We'll follow the order that I gave you. Second question is mandatory or voluntary enrollment. States have a choice when it comes to Medicaid managed care. State officials can say, you've got to, if you want to be on Medicaid in the state of New York, or if you want to be in Medicaid in the state of Texas, you are required to enroll in a managed care plan. Or the states can say, we have a managed care initiative, there are managed care plans available, but it's your choice, it's completely voluntary. So what do you think the pros and the cons are from the state's perspective on mandatory versus voluntary enrollment in managed care? And again, you have to think about this with regard to each of those populations. Yeah. Those are both good points. I mean, you know, clearly if it's mandatory, you're going to get everybody into managed care. You're going to have much more of a chance to influence. You have to worry much less about adverse selection. In a voluntary system, you could worry that, you know, who's going to join the managed care plan? You know, is it just going to be the healthy that are going to join the managed care plan? Are the sick going to stay in fee-for-service Medicaid? You don't have to worry about that if you have a mandatory enrollment model. Anybody else? Yeah.
Well, if you have a, you know, if it's voluntary, it could increase the administrative sort of burden on the state trying to keep track of everybody.
Who's in, who's out. I mean, it becomes much more administratively complex if you have a system in which some people are enrolled in managed care and others are not. Absolutely. Now, for years, prior to 1997, if you wanted to do a mandatory managed care initiative, you had to get special permission from the federal government. In 1997, as part of the Balanced Budget Act, the federal government essentially gave the states the ability, the right, to do mandatory managed care without a federal waiver. Most states, for example, New York State, started out with a voluntary initiative, but then it decided it wanted to move to a mandatory initiative. And it began to run into some problems when it moved to mandatory. You began to have situations, as was suggested in the comment, in which you had folks who really didn't want to be in managed care and who resisted. And again, right now, most states, to the extent they make it mandatory just for moms and kids. There's only one state in the country that makes it mandatory for the elderly and the disabled as well. And what state is that? Arizona. There you go. Every other state essentially makes it optional for the elderly and disabled to enroll in managed care. It's their choice. But over half the states now make it mandatory for moms and kids to enroll in managed care. Okay, that's the second question you have to think about. There are 10 questions that I post for you in these breakout sessions. Third question, I think third question is the benefit question. Is that right? Yeah, benefits. Okay. Here, let me just contrast Medicaid and Medicare. In Medicare, you've traditionally had a relatively narrow, relatively thin, relatively weak benefit package. And so managed care plans that have marketed themselves to Medicare beneficiaries have done so in large part by saying to those beneficiaries, sign up with us and we will give you some extra benefits. Sign up with us and we will give you prescription drugs, or we will give you vision coverage, or we will give you dental coverage, or we will pay your deductibles or your copays. Medicare managed care plans have historically marketed themselves by saying to beneficiaries, sign up with us and we will give you more than you now get. In the Medicaid market, however, you have the opposite phenomena. There is only one state in the country which includes the full benefit package in its Medicaid managed care initiative. And whoever says that state first is guaranteed an A in the class. What state is that? Arizona. A voice over here said it first, but I didn't see the voice. So, Other than Arizona, there's no other state, and even Arizona, is required by federal law to allow women to get family planning services from any provider they want access to, regardless of whether or not that provider is in their managed care plan. So there are certain federal laws which say even in the Arizona-type states, you can't restrict access completely. But the bigger question, and the question that you guys are going to have to think about, and the question that state officials have to think about a lot, is, are there other kinds of benefits that we want to carve out that we don't want to include in the managed care initiative? Now, one kind of benefit that 49 out of the 50 states carve out is long-term care. Every state but Arizona carves long-term care out of their managed care initiative. But there are other benefits, such as mental health, substance abuse, dental, and others, which I didn't bother including there, which a number of states exclude and others do not. For example, let's see, I think I have 23 states carve out mental health from their initiative. 24 states carve out dental. 20 carve out substance abuse. Why is it? What are the pros and cons of carving some of these services out? Why do you think states, so many states, carve out mental health, for example, from their managed care initiative? Basically, what that means, it could mean a couple of different things. Let me just explain to you what it means, then we'll talk about the carve, why they do it. If you're on Medicaid in New York State, and or some state X, and you're required to enroll in managed care, and you have a choice of five plans, and you pick Oxford, you will get a card, even though you're on Medicaid, you will get a card from Oxford saying you're a member of the Oxford health plan. However, to the extent you need mental health services, to the extent your kid needs to see a psychiatrist, or your kid needs substance abuse services, or you need mental health services of one sort or another, or you need dental services, it could well be that you won't get those services through Oxford. Instead, you will just be sent either a regular Medicaid card, and you'll just access those services the way you access any kind of services in the pre-managed care era, find a doctor who'll provide you those services, or there will be a special managed care plan, carve-out plan, just to provide those kinds of services. So there will be, for example, a mental health managed care plan that you have to get your mental health services from, or a substance abuse managed care plan that you have to get your substance abuse services from. So what are the pros and cons, and why is it you think half of the states do it and half don't? Yeah?
Well, first of all, I mean, do you have to know ahead of time if you're going to need substance abuse services? I mean, you know what I mean? Or do you just enroll it as soon as you need this?
You are, as a Medicaid beneficiary, you are entitled to substance abuse coverage. You know, it's part of the benefit package in your state. So it may be for the first 5 years you're on Medicaid, you never need that service. But after 5 years, you do need the service.
Do you switch managed?
No, you don't switch at that point. When you sign up for Medicaid, you sign up for Oxford for your general health, but you either have to sign up for a substance abuse plan or you get it through fee-for-service if it's a carve-out situation, regardless of if you're going to ever use it or not. And if you never use it, you never use it. But if it's a substance abuse carve-out plan, there's a managed care plan that's being paid a few cents every month to provide substance abuse services to you. It's as if there was a managed care plan that was carved out to provide cardiology care or you know, physical therapy. It's taking a service and saying, we're going to give a managed care plan a separate capitation fee to provide a service. And again, it won't be a lot. You know, the capitation rate will probably be pretty low because the assumption will be most beneficiaries won't ever even use the service, but it'll be a carve-out managed care plan. So what are the pros and cons to carve-outs? Why do you think states do them? Who do you think pushes for them? And what do you think the politics of that are? Yeah. So clearly, it's often hard to think about. I mean, these are hard services to provide. Absolutely. Anybody else? Yeah. Generally, that's absolutely right. These are not services that managed care plans have historically provided. Who has provided these services historically to low-income populations? Who provides mental health and substance abuse services historically to low-income populations in a city like New York? Anybody, raise your hand if you have a thought. Yeah, way in the back. Typically the city of New York. I mean, it's typically you've got county and city agencies that historically have said, you know what, whether it's city mental health agencies or city substance abuse agencies or small clinics funded by the city of New York or Philadelphia or Baltimore or Boston or Texas. These services historically have been provided to low-income populations by publicly administered, publicly funded organizations and not by commercial managed care plans. So if you work for the state of New York and you're developing this managed care initiative, what are the pros and cons of doing the carve-out? Why do you think, given that that's the historic providers, what are the pros and cons of actually doing the carve-out? Well, one con is that you're basically asking a managed care plan that's never provided the service before to now provide the service. And at the same time, you're telling the mental health community in New York City that has historically provided the service that you no longer automatically get to provide the service. It's now up to Oxford to decide whether or not you provide the service. So one negative is the traditional historic providers of these services lose out. They lose their Medicaid beneficiaries. And so instead of the New York City Office of Mental Health providing these services, you've got Oxford providing these services. And Oxford has to figure out a way to hire somebody to provide these services. On the other hand, what's the advantage of not... So that's one reason why you might want to carve out. You might want to carve out because you might say, we don't really... If we're an advocate, if I'm a community advocate or I'm a social services advocate or I work for legal services and I'm here in New York City and I really don't trust Oxford all that well, but I think that, you know, New York City has developed a pretty good program of services for low-income, mentally ill folks, I might say, I want to carve out mental health for the managed care plan and I want to keep folks getting their mental health services from the place which has historically provided them the services. But what's the counter argument? Yeah.
If you send it all to Oxford, then you don't even have to worry about it. It's their problem to organize it. It's something that administratively you won't have to deal with it.
So clearly there's an administrative benefit. But what about health-wise? What about... What would be a, and that's certainly, I agree with your point 100%, but what would be a sort of public health or a health reason why you wouldn't want to carve out? Yeah?
Because you're taking away from someone who's traditionally focused on that specific topic area, maybe someone has no prior knowledge in that, and also that they're going to want to kind of cut corners for the business aspect of it.
Well, so those are both excellent arguments for carve outs. I mean, taking what you say, those are both very good arguments to say, let's not give mental health or substance abuse to Oxford. Let's let the traditional providers, let's carve it out and let the traditional providers continue to provide the service. But what's sort of the argument on the other side? Yeah.
Like by actually giving it to Oxford or putting it to Oxford's hands, like you have the opportunity to get more people like the services that they need, like they have an easier option or...
Mm-hmm.
Like more people are getting it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could say Oxford has a big network and you can have access to that network, yeah.
You can also provide greater continuity of care, so like all the officials involved can have a dialogue about it. They can monitor meds,
okay, that's the key on this one. I mean, if one of the goals of moving to managed care is to have coordinated care, if there's supposed to be one doctor, one primary care physician who's supposed to coordinate all of your health care, the more carve-outs you have, the less coordination you have. I mean, you know, it's clearly the case that that low-income folks who are substance abusers and mentally ill are pretty likely to have a whole series of comorbidity, you know, whatever the clinicians want to call it, you know, other illnesses, other problems, other things going on. They may have HIV/AIDS, they may have TB, they may have a bad heart. I mean, there's all sorts of physical manifestations. And so if you said to a primary care doc, you're in charge of Joe Smith, and you say, all right, I'm the doc, I'm in charge of Joe Smith. I work, you know, I have a contract with Oxford, I'm a PCP, you know, I'm in charge of Joe Smith, but I don't have any control over the substance abuse and mental health services that he or she receives. You say, well, how could I really be in charge of his or her health care if I don't even know what's going on with her or her his or her mental health services or substance abuse services or dental? Yeah. Well, you know, clearly the economics of this are important, and typically what states find is that the Oxfords of the world say, you know what, we could do this cheaper than New York City's Office of Mental Health, and we get to, and by us doing it, we provide coordinated, you know, care. So they say there's a double benefit. You know, we could do it for cheaper, and we can coordinate all the services. But then the Office of Mental Health or the advocates say, well, the reason you could do it for cheaper is because you're cutting corners and you're not going to provide the services people really need. And while it's true there'd be some coordinated care, if you've got somebody coordinating the care who doesn't know anything about substance abuse, who doesn't know anything about mental health, who's not been a historic or traditional provider there, what good is the coordination of care? So this is there's no right answer to this. I mean, you're going to have to come up with the right answer, I suppose, in you know, in your groups, or at least an answer that you think makes more sense. But there's arguments on both sides, and as I said, states have split on it. You know, the numbers I gave you, this was a survey of 45 states. And of those 45 states, you know, 23 carved out mental health, 24 carved out dental, and 20 carved out substance abuse. And you can go through similar numbers on some other, you know, 49 carved out long-term care. But it's particularly in those areas, substance abuse and mental health, where states have split. And that becomes an administrative, a political, an economic, and a health decision that administrators have to make. Okay. Next issue I have on the list is marketing and enrollment. You say to yourself, well, geez, this doesn't seem that tough. You know, say you're doing a mandatory managed care initiative. You're requiring everybody in the state of Minnesota who's on Medicaid to enroll in managed care. Well, there are two tasks immediately at hand. Number one, you have to let those people know what their choices are, because ideally you're going to want them to choose their health plan. You know, if they have a choice of five or six health plans in Minneapolis, you want them to choose which health plan makes the most sense for them. So you have to educate them, you have to market to them, you have to let them know what their choices are. And then you have to enroll them in the program. So you say, all right, how do we do that? Well, one choice, one option, is to simply let the health plans go out and market themselves. You know, if there are 20 health plans in New York City, let those health plans go to the welfare centers and put out tables and tell people sign up with us. Let those health plans go to health fairs. Let them go to the projects. Let them send out marketers. Let them send out newsletters about their health plan. Let them set up shop in the ground floor of Presbyterian Hospital. I mean, basically, let the health plan say, enroll in our plan. So that's one clear option, that the health plans are allowed to do all the marketing they want, and when somebody comes to the health plan and says, we want to sign up with you, the health plan gives them a form, signs them up, and sends it into Medicaid. That's option A. What's the problem with that option? What's the pros and the pros and the cons, either or? What's good? Excuse me? The biggest companies win. So clearly those companies that have the biggest marketing budget, that have the most marketers, that could send people out to the projects, that can have television ads or do whatever they do, are in better shape. What else? Yeah.
Individuals don't just see what companies that are for them. They just are places for information for them.
They just get, it's like what's going on with Medicare managed care right now with the elderly. You know, you get 35 pieces of mail saying join us and here's why. And who knows what that really means. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there have been allegations of fraud and abuse in direct marketing situations where, you know, the marketers will knock on the doors, you know, in low-income communities, and they'll say, you're on Medicaid, and yes, join our plan. Well, what about, you know, I go to the clinic, I go to the Mercy Clinic. Is that included in your network? Of course it's included in our network. Sign up, sign here, they sign up, they sign here. They go to the Mercy Clinic the next week. They show their card, and the card says, and the clinic officials say, "Sorry, we're not in that plan." Or the potential beneficiary says, "I need mental health services. Where do I get mental health services?" And they say, "You get them here, here, and here." So there have been, and it turns out not to be true. So there have been allegations because a lot of these marketers for the plan, while they're legally and officially not supposed to be paid a commission for everybody they sign up, in effect, through the use of bonuses and other rewards, they are often paid commissions, in effect. And so they have a real incentive to sign people up. You know, the more you can sign up, the better off you are, whether or not it's in the interest of the client to sign up with you. So some of the concerns people have about direct marketing is that it does contain potential for abuse. It does contain for potential for domination by the big plans. It does contain, even if no abuse, potential for confusion. On the other hand, there's a real benefit too. And the benefit is you're actually talking to somebody from a plan, so if the person's not going to lie to you, you're really going to find out that, you know, what's the case with that plan. And if you talk to 10 different people from 10 different plans, maybe you really will figure out which is the right plan for you. So that's one way states have gone. A second way states have gone, and I mentioned Minnesota before. Minnesota is a perfect example here. In Minnesota, the managed care plans are prohibited by law from doing any marketing to the beneficiaries. They're prohibited from doing marketing to the beneficiaries, and they're not allowed to enroll anybody. Instead, what happens is when you sign up for Medicaid, or when you sign up for CHIP, you are shown a movie about managed care. In that movie, there's brief little descriptions of the five managed care options that you have. And then you sit down with the county Medicaid or county welfare representative, and that representative has the brochures from the five plans, has the networks from the five plans, and says, these are your choices, pick one. And you ask whatever questions you want of the county representative, and you pick a plan. Relatively few states follow that model, though. Why do you think that's so? What are the pros and cons? Yeah. Absolutely. The comment was, for those who couldn't hear it, that the state and or the county is actually paying for all those workers to provide you with that set of information. It's extremely costly to have a system like that. It costs a lot of money. Yeah. Absolutely. The worker might not, you know, the worker might not have a real good sense of, you know, what the plan is like beyond what the brochure says. And so in particular, if you're a small plan, getting back to that small big comment that was made over here, I mean, if you're U.S. Healthcare, United Healthcare, or Aetna, I mean, everybody knows who you are. And when you got the brochure from Aetna, everybody knows who you are and there's no problem. On the other hand, if you're a small little safety net health plan that's starting out on your own, and you don't get to do any direct marketing, you don't get to talk to people, you're prohibited from talking to people, you have to rely on a brochure and a county worker, you may not get very many people to sign up with your plan. And on top of that, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, there is a county-run health plan. And so there's certainly a perception or a possibility that the county workers will be encouraged to encourage beneficiaries to sign up with the county health plan as opposed to the other health plans. Now, only because Minnesota folks are so honest, you know, maybe that doesn't happen. But in New York, you know, it's a whole different story. No, there's definitely questions, even in Minnesota, about whether or not the bias, the potential bias the county workers might have in favor of the county plan outweighs any benefits that accrue from the system that Minnesota uses. Somebody, hey, how, yeah. Mm-hmm. There could be, actually, that's a good idea. That's an interesting idea. The states could say to the health plans, in effect, we're going to impose a tax on you and use that tax to pay for some of the high cost, you know, that accrues from this. The health plans would vigorously object to that because they would say, geez, not only don't we get to talk to people, but we have to actually pay not to talk to people. I guess the answer is, yes, states could do that. I don't know of any state that does do that. And I think there would be fierce resistance to it on the part of the insurance industry, but it certainly is an option and would make some sense. Third option, if you don't like the direct enrollment and you don't like the county doing it, the third option is to hire what's known as an enrollment broker. That's a company whose reason for being in existence is to do enrollment marketing and enrollment education and signing people up. That's their job. And so you say, all right, well, at least we don't have any bias here, and maybe it's a little bit cheaper. You know, instead of meeting one-on-one with people, most of these companies, what they do is they mail the Medicaid beneficiaries a packet of material saying, here are your five choices. Pick one. If you have any questions, here's an 800 number and call us. And if you don't pick one, we're just going to assign you to one. So what are the pros and cons of using brokers, do you think? Yeah?
It seems like one of the least direct services that options that we have, even though like the county representative, we were annoyed that suggested a lot of cons for that.
Mm-hmm.
Like it seems like for the enrollment broker, there's no communication between the person. And
right. No, I mean, clearly, you know, the pro is, I suppose, the argument for doing it, this is their business, so they can do it pretty cheap. The negative is, exactly as you point out, these are often national companies that don't know a whole lot about these managed care plans, that often get these contracts from the state to, you know, do this marketing enrollment on a relatively cheap basis. So they have 800 numbers set up, and beneficiaries call the 800 numbers, and they can't get through. They get put on hold. They finally get put through. They get somebody at the other end of the 800 number who doesn't really have the answer to all their questions. They can't call somebody from the plan. They can't call somebody from the state. They're stuck with this enrollment broker. I mean, there's clearly some concerns about how these have played out. At the end of the day, those are the three main options that states have come up with so far, and none of those three options have been viewed as particularly great. States have tried a little bit to mix and match. For example, New York State, just to give you an example, New York State used to have direct marketing and enrollment, complete direct marketing and enrollment. Then in the mid-90s, there were all these scandals. The advocacy community said, you know, there's all sorts of fraud and abuse going on. Marketers are signing people up illegally. People are being signed up for plans they didn't know they were being signed up for. Big fiasco. So for a couple of years, New York State completely suspended direct plan enrollment and said everybody had to sign up at the welfare offices, Medicaid offices. But then New York said, geez, we have 4 million people on Medicaid. There's no way in the world we can afford to do this. It's just unbelievably expensive. We can't sign people up. You know, we have to, you know, have somebody else do this. We can't tax the insurance companies in New York, at least. We don't think we can get away with taxing them to pay for the cost of this. So New York hired a broker. But then there were problems with the broker here in New York because the concern was, geez, the broker doesn't really know the plans, doesn't really know what's going on. There's fraud with the broker. There's problems with the broker. There's issues with the broker. That's not... So New York was saying, geez, none of these three things work so well. So then what New York did, and what New York is basically doing right now, is New York allows plans to market directly now. And it allows plans to begin the enrollment process. However, they've got a broker that they've hired here in New York. And what the broker does, it's kind of like when you switch from Verizon to MCI. You know, you're on the phone with Verizon for 15 minutes and they're telling you all about... You know, in fact, I just did this past weekend. I didn't switch from Verizon to... I just switched to, you know, how every day in the mail you get one of these things now from Time Warner or Optimal or whatever, you know, for their triple plays, you know, the phone, cable, internet, everything all in one. So this past weekend I switched to a triple play. And so I switched my phone from Verizon to Time Warner. I already had Time Warner for internet and Time Warner for, what's the third, TV. So I switched my phone to Time Warner. But when you're switching phone services, when you're doing this kind of thing, you go through the whole thing with the people at Time Warner or whoever it is, and after you've had this 45-minute chat with them, they say, all right, I'm going to put you on hold now, and then we're going to get the verification people or whoever it is. They're going to pick up the phone, and they're going to verify that you're really who you are and you really want to make this change. Well, that's what happens here in Medicaid now in New York. You know, if there's a health plan that wants to sign you up and they're in the hospital and you stop by and they convince you to sign up with their health plan, after they convince you to sign up, the health plan marketer has to take out his cell phone and call up someone from the broker, you know, the enrollment broker's office, and put you on the phone with someone from the broker. And they're supposed to run through a whole series of questions to make sure that you were really told of all your options and it was all done correctly and all the, you know, T's were crossed and I's were dotted and everything's kosher. The health plans hate it because the health plans say, you know, you got some mom with four kids in the ER, you know, you get her for 5 minutes to, like, agree to sign up with your plan, and then... You know, she has to sit there for 15 minutes while you try to get the verified broker on the phone, and the kid starts crying and she leaves, and, you know, the whole thing falls apart. So the health plans don't like it, and the broker gets all sorts of abuse. But basically, nobody knows how to do enrollment and marketing effectively and well. And so it's been one of those administrative tasks that none of the... I mean, Minnesota is very happy with their system. They're actually very happy with their system. But it's a very expensive system. And some of the health plans are not so happy with the system because they complain about it. You also have the problem, one of the advantages of the Minnesota model is 99% of the people pick a plan immediately upon, you know, talking to the county worker. I mean, 99.9% of the people pick a plan right then and there. They could change their mind later, but they pick a plan right then and there. If you've got a mandatory managed care initiative and you've got a broker and the broker sends you a brochure saying sign up with one of the following eight plans, and if you don't sign up with one of the following eight plans, we're going to enroll you in one, that's what's known, and you don't sign up with one of those plans. And again, Medicaid beneficiaries, when they get these packets in the mail, they often don't read the packets. They often don't understand the packets. They often don't pick up, you know, and make a choice. You know, they've got difficult lives, many of them. They've got busy lives. They have a lot going on. The materials are complicated. The materials are confusing. They don't make a choice. And so they then get assigned to a plan. Now, how do you think assignment takes place? And again, states have... If you're a Medicaid official in the state of New York and you have to decide how you're going to assign people to health plans who don't choose on their own, what are some of your options? Again, these are all things, and actually administering or running one of these things that you have to think about. How do you assign people to a plan? What are some of the options? Any ideas? One way is just randomly. You could say, you know, first person goes to plan A, second person plan B, third person plan C, fourth person plan D. You know, just run through all the plans randomly. How else? Geographically, you could say, well, let's try to match your zip code with the health plan that's got the most doctors in your network. So you can do it by zip code, by geography. How else? Yeah.
Maybe depending on the type of group out of like the four or three groups that the Medicaid.
I mean, maybe you could try to place people by, in effect, diagnosis. If you know somebody has HIV/AIDS, if there's a certain plan that specializes in that, or if there's someone, you know, if you could sort of look at plans and try to match plans for the disabled or the elderly or the young or whoever, you could try to do something like that. Any other ideas? Yeah. You could say, who's their doctor? Who's their clinic? You know, and what clinic or what doctor do they use and what plan is that doctor or clinic most, you know, heavily involved with? Other states do things like they say, we will assign based on enrollment in the plans. So if you have five plans in the market, and one of the plans has 25% of the Medicaid beneficiaries, one has 20, one has 15, one has 10, and one has 5, whatever those numbers add up to, you can do your auto assignment, giving 25% of the auto assignments to the biggest plan, 20 to the next biggest, 15 to the next biggest, and so forth. Basically, assign based on voluntary enrollment. Another thing you can do is you could say, we want to actually use auto assignment to actually achieve a policy goal. There may be a particular plan that we want to give a leg up to. We want to give them some members. We want to give them some beneficiaries. And so we are going to say that a safety net health plan, a community-based safety net health plan, just because we think it's good state policy, we're going to give them more enrollees to help them out. Lots of choices, lots of options, lots of way of doing it. I mean, again, you know, this is not rocket science, nor is this, you know, John Grisham drama. You know, this is not the most exciting stuff in the world. But these are the kinds of choices that you don't often think about. Auto assignment, how is that done? Well, how you structure your auto assignment program, particularly in many states, you've got over 50% of the Medicaid beneficiaries are auto assigned. They do not themselves choose a plan. You are going to assign them to a plan. And how you make those assignments could make or break health plans, could have dramatic impact on the healthcare services received by the beneficiaries. I mean, it's a big decision how you structure that. All right, that's enrollment and marketing. Next item on the list here is PCCM versus MCO. PCCM stands for Primary Care Case Management. And in a primary care case management system, the state itself is acting, is serving as the managed care plan, and the state itself contracts directly with primary care providers, and it pays them a few bucks a month to manage the care of the Medicaid beneficiary. Primary care case management programs. These programs started in rural areas, states with large rural areas, because the assumption was and the reality was there weren't a lot of health plans in those communities that would actually agree to sign up to take Medicaid beneficiaries. But over time, more and more states have said, you know, we like the PCCM model. We like contracting directly with doctors and having, in effect, us, the state, be the managed care plan. Why should we hire Oxford? Why should we hire Aetna? Why should we hire HealthNet? We'll be the managed care plan. That's a primary care case management program. The alternative choice is to say, forget us, the state, being in charge of the managed care initiative. We want to hire a private plan, or a public plan if it's a public hospital, but we want to hire an HMO or a managed care organization, whether it's because you believe the system would be better off if it's run by private organizations as opposed to public, whether it's because you believe they're more efficient, for whatever reason, you think it's better to hire health plans and to pay them a capitation rate than it is to you, for you, the state, to be in charge of hiring docs to be your managed care providers. So those are the two models there, and you have to decide which of those models you want to go for. Early on, most states went for the health plan model. In the last 5 years, more and more states are moving toward PCCM approaches. Another big issue, though, another big question that states have to decide. Next question. Now, the next few questions actually assume you're going to use health plans. So in the breakout session, even if you pick PCCM, you have to answer these next few questions as if you were picking health plans. What type of health plan do you want to lure into your market? I think it was last week I mentioned to you that in just about every state in the country that started a Medicaid managed care initiative, and you see Bob Hurley talks about it in his article that I had you read, and I talk about it in the article I had you read that I wrote with Larry Brown, just about every state in the country that does managed care starts out by trying to lure into their market Oxford, Prudential, Health Net, the big commercial managed care plans, Aetna. That's the goal. The idea is let's get the big private players in that'll mainstream our Medicaid beneficiaries, that'll put them in these big private plans. They've got commercial enrollees as well. They're exactly where we want our Medicaid beneficiaries to be. That's who we want in our market. And states started out effectively luring many of those plans into the marketplace. They lured them into the marketplace by paying them pretty high rates. At the same time, and this we did talk about last week because we were talking about community health centers last week, at the same time, community health centers and public hospitals and public health clinics said to themselves, geez, if these big commercial health plans dominate the Medicaid market, that could be trouble for us. We could lose our Medicaid beneficiaries in our community health center or in our public hospital. So we want to form our own safety net health plan. And so around the country, and I talk about this in the Uneasy Alliances article that I had you read, around the country, safety net providers begin forming health plans. And then entering into the market are these for-profit, publicly traded, commercial managed care plans that market only to the Medicaid beneficiary. Medicaid-only commercial plans. They don't operate in the traditional commercial markets. They're Medicaid-only, for-profit, publicly traded plans. So you've got three different kinds of health plans in the Medicaid market. States then had all of these health plans bidding and competing to participate in the Medicaid arena. States responded by cutting the rates, saying, well, geez, we have so many players, we don't need to pay so much money. The commercial plans began exiting. And more and more and more in recent years, Medicaid managed care initiatives have been dominated by safety net health plans and Medicaid-only plans. There have been fewer and fewer commercial health plans. Except there's a pro and a con to that. And some states have said, well, we want to lure back Aetna. We want to lure back Oxford because we think it's good for our beneficiaries to have access to those plans. Other states have said, good riddance. We're better off without you. We're better off with simply using the same old safety net plans and Medicaid-only plans that we've used successfully or historically over the last few years. So that's another question you have to grapple with. Next question I have on my list here is whether or not the state should actually try to make it easier or better for the safety net health plans to survive. Remember I said a lot of the commercial health plans exited because they weren't getting enough money. Well, that left behind the safety net health plans, and the safety net health plans began saying, geez, we're not sure we can survive. And so some states said, well, geez, we need you to survive. We need you in this market. How could we keep you in this market? And I list here various things that states have done to try to keep safety net health plans in the market. Give them some funding, startup funding. Pay them higher rates. Allow the safety net health plans to have lower reserve and capitalization requirements. Give them an edge. We were just talking about this a few minutes ago. Give them an edge in auto assignment. You know, assign more and more enrollees to the safety net health plans as opposed to the others. Question.
I'm confused because when we do these breakout sessions, are we like pretending that we're safety net?
No, you're a state official. You're a state official.
Okay.
Yep. And so the question on this one is, should we in New York State have a safety net protection plan? You could say no. You could say what we really want is we want to lure Oxford back into our market. We don't want to give any, you know, why should we give an extra benefit to the safety net health plans? We don't think they're as good. Or you could say, yes, we do want a safety net health plan. And if you say, yes, we do, here's how we want to do it. Next question is how many health plans do you want in your market? I mean, you don't have to do anything other than open up a newspaper these days in the Medicare managed care arena, in the Medicare drug arena to see. And actually, I have to say, just this afternoon, I actually tried. My mother is a Medicare beneficiary. And for the last couple of months, I've been saying to her, you know, you got to think about what you're doing with this new Medicare drug bill. You know, we have to figure out what you want to do here because you have till May 15th and then there's a penalty. And she says, I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to deal with it. And so finally, she said to me, what should I do about this, in effect? Yeah, I don't know what to do about this. And so I said, you know, well, we have to figure out what makes sense. And I think it does make sense for you to join a plan before May 15th because there'll be a penalty. I said to her, without giving too much away, I said, are there any medications that you use on a regular basis? And she said, there's one. You know, and she gave me the name of this drug that she uses on a semi-regular basis that she pays X dollars for. And so I said, all right, I'm going to figure this out for you. So this afternoon, here I was at my office, and I went on to the Medicare website, and I plugged in her zip code. I plugged in this one drug that she, you know, says she uses on a fairly regular basis. I plugged in whatever other information they wanted, and I hit continue. And it said there were 50 health plans, or whatever it is, that she has a choice of. So I said, all right, yeah, I'm going to, you know. So then I plugged in 50 health plans that, you know, could give her a good deal on this drug and, you know, et cetera. So I said, all right, let me look at these 50 plans. It was kind of interesting. So I hit continue. And on the screen, it came up there were 5 health plans on the screen. And it had the name of the health plan, whether there'd be a deductible, whether there'd be a copay, whether or not the drug would be considered like a tier 2 or a regular, or, you know, how the what the drug would be considered. And it also had a list of participating pharmacies. You know, well, it actually, you had to click a link to get the participating pharmacies. But so there were these 5 health plans. I thought, well, this is pretty cool. But I want to look at all 50 health plans. But at the bottom of the page, there was one of those things where there's like a number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. But there was no all. So in order to look at the 50 health plans, I had to click 10 times and look at 5 at a time. And then, you know, ultimately print out, you know, all 50. But then if you print out all 50, you have to go back to look at, like, the participating pharmacies, and you have to look at, the, you know, what they do with this particular drug. Is it a, you know, is it considered a tier 1, or do they use a generic? You have to look at, you know, they have all sorts of other things about, you know, do you want, because on for each one it says, do you want, in addition to this other information, it also says, do you want a higher deductible or a lower deductible? Because we also have other plans within this plan where we'll give you a higher deductible or a lower deductible, but it's going to change your premium cost. So it's not really 50. It's really God knows how many choices there are. And then I've got my own little biases because the first one that came up as being the cheapest plan was Humana, and I'm thinking, oh, I don't really know if I want her to join Humana. That doesn't seem, you know, and so I got a headache. And I said, I called up, I said, you're on your own, you know. I said, you know, sorry, Ma, you know, get yourself somebody who knows something about this. I can't figure it out. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But I guess, you know, I didn't really tell her that. I have to confess. I thought that. I said, you know, I better get a pretty good meal out of this or something. But I gave up. I said, I got class to prepare tonight. I can't spend my whole time, you know, looking for a drug. It was really... And I haven't, I mean, I've played around a little bit in the past, but I never really had tried. And I don't know if any of you have tried. you know, to go through in detail. And there's a, on the plus side, I will say, there's an enormous amount of information available on that website. I mean, they will give you, you know, whoever was designing that website said, what's every possible thing, you know, that somebody could want to know about their choices? On the negative side, it's just overwhelming, the amount of choices and amount of information. Yeah. I assume, yes, that Medicare probably sends, but how much everything is, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they list, they'll send you your 50 health plans, but whether or not they'll send you the participating pharmacies for all 50 of those health plans, or whether or not, they certainly won't list, have a thing where you can plug in, you know, the prescription drugs you take on a regular basis. You'll have to, I guess, in that situation, start making phone calls, you know, to these different health plans. That brings us back to the question here, in Medicaid or in any managed care plan, how many health plans do you want in the market? What's the right number of health plans? And so I list four choices here, four different ways states do it. There are places in the country that say one health plan and that's it, and we're going to pick the health plan. There are counties, for example, in California, San Mateo, San Bernardino, you know, several counties, certainly San Mateo and a bunch of others as well, in which if you're a Medicaid beneficiary in that county, you don't have any choice. There's one health plan, and you're automatically enrolled in that health plan. No choice. In California, there's also what's known as the two-plan model, historically, and other states have similar things, where you're given a choice of two health plans as a beneficiary. And health plans bid or compete to be one of those two plans. But the beneficiary ends up with just two choices, plan A or plan B. And some plans just lose out on the market because they don't, you know. Other states say we're going to have competitive bidding and we're going to have 3 to 5 health plans. That's our magic number. You know, we don't want more than 5 because it gets confusing. We want more than 2 because that doesn't seem like it's enough choice. We want 3 or 5. But they'll have competitive bidding. The majority of states, including New York State, basically say any qualified plan that meets our criteria will allow into the program. So there are places here in New York where Medicaid beneficiaries have a choice of 15, 20, 22 plans. So again, you have a choice to make. Do you believe the more competition, the better? Do you believe the less competition, the better? One plan, just basically you have the state pick a plan. Do you believe sort of moderate competition? I mean, these are all different options, all different choices. Next issue. My goal, just to let you know, is basically to sort of end this discussion overview by a few minutes after 7, have you take a break, and then have you go to the groups. Next option is how you're going to pay these health plans. How are you going to pay the health plans? One way that states do it, and probably the most common way, is for the state simply to say, we're going to set the rates. We're going to say, maybe we'll set them based on geography. We're going to say in New York City, health plans that enroll, that participate in the Medicaid initiative are going to get $100 for everybody they sign up. And maybe we'll have some adjustments if the people are a little bit sicker or a little less sick. Maybe we'll do some risk adjustment for health status or age or whatever. But we're going to set the rates so that all the plans get the same rates. Everybody gets the same rates. On the other hand, other states say, no, we want to have plan-specific rates. We either want to enter into separate negotiations with every health plan in which we look at what that health plan, how much money that health plan made the prior year, how they're doing, how many enrollees they had, how it all played out, and we, through a negotiation process with them, come up with what seems like a fair rate that's acceptable to both sides. Or we say to them, you bid. We'll issue an RFP and you bid. again, the majority of states right now simply set rates. A large number of states also do negotiated rates, and a handful of states do competitive bidding. Very different alternatives. And again, I'd have you walk through the pros and cons, but I, at this point I want to sort of move you through it just to get you sort of talking about some of this so you can talk about some of the pros and cons in your groups. Last issue, and on this issue, I've listed, you know, the question is, and this is really one of the most important issues, but also the one you're going to be least equipped to answer in the group this evening, is how you as the state encourage or ensure good quality care. Now, we are the week of, well, we're a week behind, aren't we? But presumably the week of April 17th, but if not April 17th, then the April 24th, because we do have an extra, I mean, the last class where we talk about the American healthcare system, I sort of got, where do we go from here? That's sort of open, because I'm not even sure what I was planning on covering then. Kind of ran out of things to talk. No, that's not true. But I figured I just wanted to leave that week open just to either cover material we hadn't finished in the class or just to, if there was something new and interesting. So I'm not sure if I'm going to talk about medical malpractice or mental health, or actually if you have things that you would like covered in a class like this around health policy, you can even send me an email. I'm trying to figure out what I want to do with that last class, what I think would be interesting. But at some point in the next few weeks, we're going to talk about quality of care. We're going to spend a whole class on quality of care. We haven't done that yet. So what I want to do, I'm using this today, this quality of care question to you, almost as a survey that I'm going to then use again when I talk about quality of care. I've listed 8 different ways here that the state of New York or a state could try to encourage good quality care. You know, basically doing beneficiary satisfaction surveys to try to get a sense of what beneficiaries think of the quality of care they're receiving, and then have state action based on that. Having all sorts of state rules imposed on the plans, either internal grievance procedures, provide a network adequacy, provide a credentialing, basically have the state set rules about designed to encourage good quality. Have the state set up an external grievance protocol system where if you're worried about or if you want to complain about the quality of care you're receiving in a particular plan, you get to go to some external organization outside of the plan to air your complaint, requiring disease management programs for asthma, diabetes, you know, basically focusing on disease management, chronic care management initiatives, requiring reporting requirements, and I say here NCQA or state-based. NCQA is the National Commission for Quality Assurance. We're going to talk about this more when we do quality. But basically the idea here is to say to the health plans, we're going to do audits, in effect. We're going to ask you how many of your enrollees got their immunizations, you know, in a timely fashion. How many women at a certain age got, you know, mammograms? How many men of a certain age got screening for prostate cancer? You know, whatever the variable is, we're going to pick a host of variables, and we're going to audit you for your compliance rate with those variables. That's another option. Another option is to in effect issue report cards on health plans by doing provider profiling. Provider profiling, which we're going to talk a lot about when we do quality, is basically, again, picking variables but now looking at the providers and saying, how are the providers performing? And rating health plans based on the performance of their providers. Another option is pay for performance, basically saying to health plans, we're going to pick some variables, and based on your performance on those variables, we're going to pay you more money or pay you less money. And again, we're going to be talking a lot about pay-for-performance when we talk about quality. And the last idea focuses on new health information technologies. And we not only have a special class on HIT, but we also have a guest speaker on HIT, Bob Challoner, who's the CEO of Cabrini Hospital here in New York City, talking about what they're doing around HIT and quality and so forth. So the idea here is I want you to go through these 8 on quality and just pick out, again, without knowing all the details of how this all works, pick out the 3 ideas that seem like the best ideas to you around quality as a group. And then I'm going to use that in my discussion with you later in the semester around quality. So what you need to do is go through this list and in effect create a managed care initiative. Decide which beneficiaries you're going to require, which beneficiaries are going to be in your managed care initiative, whether it's going to be mandatory or voluntary, how you're going to do marketing, what benefits you're going to have, what kind of health plans you want to have, how you're going to pay rates, and some of these. So you have to answer all these questions. And then you have to, again, through the use of bullet points, and you guys did a nice job on this at the last breakout session, through the use of bullet points, quickly explain all of your choices. And then when you're done with that, write it all up, send it to me and your TA who's assigned to you for this particular exercise, and then go home. And then I'll see you next week. So I think that's it. So we'll take about a 10-minute break for you to sort of find your way to where you need to go, and then we'll take it from there.
Yeah. When it comes to the rates that states pay plans,
right.
Is there any data on whether states who negotiate rates have lower rates versus